Thanks, Molly, for the technical assistance and for organizing this great symposium. So I'm excited. This is one of my first opportunities to present work from my new lab somewhere besides University of Washington, where I am now. So I'll start with some preliminary published work and then move on to unpublished things. So to start with, I think this sort of classical view of mutagenesis that we tried to push back on a bit is thinking of mutation as one of the more boring population genetic processes where you have maybe mutations as input and then out you get new traits for selection to act upon. And so when we say mutation is this ultimate source of genetic variation, as you often see in the literature, you know, you think of it as causing interesting genetics, but not necessarily being an interesting trait in itself. But there's some emerging, like really cool evidence that DNA replication fidelity is itself a trait that's interesting to study, and that it's probably a highly polygenic trait with that won't be resolved anytime soon as to how it varies and why. And so looking at humans, we now have a reasonable handle as of the past not very many years that mutation rate is about 1 times 10 to the minus 8th changes per site per generation. And so in the classical view, that's this clock where every site, like clockwork, changes about this quickly. But then if you think of mutagenesis as more of a quantitative trait instead, then just like you have variation among height of people, you should have some kind of a variation in the population around this mean value that can be estimated. And it's really hard to estimate mutation rates very precisely because you only sample a small number of mutations in each child of each individual. So I think it's hard to say like how much, say, stabilizing selection this trait might be under, how much it varies within populations. So we're having to think about creative ways to get at this just because mutation rate measurements are so noisy. And so there's a lot of forces that could influence mutation rate, maybe both proximately and ultimately. Things like the strength of selection on replication fidelity varying with population size and various environmental forces that could make it more challenging to replicate DNA accurately. And so I'm sure this isn't even an exhaustive list of the forces that could change it one way or another. And we don't really know which are the most important at play on short timescales. And so one really important insight from cancer that we've made an effort to sort of port into the evolutionary field is this idea of mutational signatures. And this is a way of increasing the dimensionality of the mutagenesis trait from just a single number into a more complex phenotype that makes it a bit easier to study. So with mutational signatures, some of the first ones you think of are due to environmental exposures, say the genomes of lung cancers that result from tobacco exposure tend to have mutations from C to A. And then there are endogenous processes that can also cause mutational signatures, like defects in this replicative polymerase epsilon, creating mutations in particular triplet contexts, and then even more exotic things like ApoBec enzymes that can mutate viral RNA on purpose and sometimes cause off-target mutations in the germline. And so how can this help us study mutation rate as a complex trait? So just conceptually, you can imagine different signatures possibly being active in the germline, say at different phases in development of male and female gametes and the early embryo. And that if the mutation rate is going to vary between individuals or change, it probably doesn't affect every one of these hypothetical signatures equally. And so maybe you can tell that the mutation rate has subtly changed in one population versus another by looking for an imbalance in the dosage of different signatures that occur. And so when I first started to look for this sort of signature, I found a much stronger signal than I ever expected to find of when you compare private SNPs segregating in different human populations, Africans and Europeans and East Asians, you find about 50% more mutations of this particular type, TCC, mutating to TTC in Europeans compared to these other groups that are really have only diverged within the past 50,000 years or so. And so this shows that there does appear to be a change and an imbalance in the proportion of mutational signatures acting in the human germline, though it doesn't tell you what the cause is, even whether it's genetic or environmental. And so there's a lot of work to be done, both trying to narrow down this cause and saying how often this kind of spectrum shift occurs. And so When Jonathan Pritchard and I followed up on this initial observation, looking at the allele frequencies of these segregating TCC to TTC mutations, and we actually found evidence that the mutation rate changed twice, not just once in this recent history of Europeans, of the rate going up and then going down again, which you can get by modeling the dependence of allele frequency on allele age. And so to visualize what these differences actually are, I'm going to show some of these heat map plots where they represent comparisons between two populations. And so say if you fill in just this C to T mutation square in the middle, you look at the x-axis for the 3' adjacent base and the y-axis for the 5' one. And so then this dark red square at the top is the TCC to TTC type that I mentioned. And if you fill in the rest of it, then you see perhaps other signatures that are more subtly different between groups, in this case Europeans and Africans, of maybe overall mutations from C being more common in Africa and mutations from A and T being more common in Europe. And then another way to visualize this that I'll show are these PCA plots, where you can take you can summarize the mutation spectrum of an individual by taking their derived alleles at segregating sites and making this 96-dimensional histogram of the mutational types and running PCA on these like quite compressed summaries of the individual genomes. And it's a kind of cool result that this spectrum in humans is enough to assign the continent of origin. So it sort of evokes these population SNP level PCA plots that are able to classify individuals into populations, but then this is a vector of several thousand dimensions instead of less than 100 and much more information. So now I'm going to turn from looking at within humans to looking maybe how has this mutation spectrum phenotype evolved over the great apes, over a bit of a longer period. And so one thing that we've known for a while is that there was this phenomenon of the hominoid mutation rate slow down, where it looks like substitutions as a whole went more quickly per year and per generation in primates that are more distantly related to humans, and that they've gone more quickly, or that they've sort of slowed down the closer you get in the ape tree to humans. Some of this is probably explained by changes in paternal age over time, of lengthening generation times as you get closer to humans in the tree, but there are also indications that not all of it is explained by that. And then some work from Molly's group showed that there were likely some associated spectrum changes during this evolution as well, as you would expect, since it's millions of years and we already have spectrum changes within humans in a few thousand years. And so what happened to the great ape mutation spectra during this hominoid slowdown? So we published a few preliminary indications of this in our work on the human spectrum. So just working with this great ape genome diversity project containing about 80 genomes from humans, chimps, gorillas, orangutans. So if you compare it to closely related lineages like a bonobo and a chimp, at least on the color scale I'm showing, these, their mutation spectra are pretty similar. But then if you compare a human to a chimpanzee, you start to see more stripy patterns that represent signature differences of, say, it looks like relatively more of the mutations occurring at CPG sites in humans, and strangely being transversions rather than the C to T transitions that you typically associate with these sites. That's the red stripe at the top. And then if you compare human to gorilla, this slightly more distant pair of lineages, you also see more pronounced spectrum differentiation and maybe more different block-like signatures than you pick up in the human-chimp comparison. And so like an interesting pattern that this starts to get at is like instead of just one-off weird changes like the TCC pulse in Europeans, just a steady drift of the mutation spectrum phenotype changing over time in the apes as you get to a more distant evolutionary separation. And so my student, Michael Goldberg, has been working on fleshing out more about saying why are the, how exactly are the great ape mutational processes different from each other. And so one of the first things he did was to, of course, make one of these PCA plots for great ape diversity. It sort of has the humans inset as this little blob at the bottom. And you remember humans on their own show a certain amount of structure differentiation, but then on this scale of apes, it's all compressed together again. And then actually this great ape genome diversity project contains four different subspecies of chimps as well as three different subspecies of gorillas. And the subspecies of gorillas all look pretty similar to each other. And there's just one of the four chimps, these Western chimpanzees, that look quite different. And that was exciting to us because of some preliminary work that showing that both that sort of the outgroup to other chimps, but they also have some interesting genomic characteristics like more transposable element proliferation. And so you can also sort of see this pattern I alluded to before of the ape mutation spectra clustering by phylogeny, where you have this sort of line in the middle of PC1 separating the human chimp bonobo lineage from other apes, as well as other divisions you can draw that correspond to branches in the tree. And so going back to this theoretical schematic of forces that can impact mutation rate. So of course we'd like to know which of these have been active during ape evolution and contributing to these patterns. And so the way that I'm going to start narrowing this down is to look at the spatial distribution of mutations to get more information on what caused them. And so just when I thought of how to illustrate this, perhaps for less sophisticated audiences than this one, I thought about this board game of Candyland that shows a genome-like object running through various hazards. And so you could think of, oh, some regions might have the mutagenic hazard of transcription of genes, and others might have methylation, which we know also increases mutation rate in certain contexts, and recombination that happens in hot spots, and that there's growing evidence is mutagenic as well. And so this motivated the subdivision of the ape genomes into some different compartments to see whether certain compartments seem to have their mutation spectra evolving faster than others. And so we've also started to think about this division of mutation rate modifiers into cis-acting and trans-acting ones, which is an analogy from, of course, inspired by work on gene expression, where you could have cis modifiers of gene expression related to sequence of, oh, if a sequence changes, say, in a transcription factor binding site, you might change nearby expression, or you could have a trans-acting change in a transcription factor itself that might change gene expression farther away. And so You can think of examples like changes to replication timing, transcription, etc., that would be likely to modify the mutation spectrum in cis in certain compartments, but then also changes to broad pathways and perhaps polymerases or repair enzymes that might have some compartment asymmetries, but more broadly affect the genome. And so we asked whether interspecies mutation spectrum differences would be dominated more by cis versus trans differences. And so I'm going to start with just two contrasting genomic compartments to illustrate what we're looking for. And so we decided, of course, for compartment one to pick sort of the most generic, boring DNA we could find, just to take the third of the genome that has no evidence of conservation by the standard phylo-P metric, and also no repetitive DNA is identified by repeat masker. So I'll call this the non-repetitive, non-conserved NRNC compartment. And for a more interesting compartment, we decided to look at endogenous retrovirus-derived DNA, which has this distinctive origin of selfish elements replicating. And this is quite ancient in this case, since we're looking at ERVs that are present in all the apes and probably didn't originate this way very recently in the past. And then also they have some distinctive epigenetic modifications and also like maybe attacked by distinctive cellular processes or have been during their origin, as I alluded to before with ApoBec enzymes that preferentially try to mutate selfish-derived DNA. And so we know that there's also been a change in ERV activity during ape evolution with sort of the measures to make these die down, getting more aggressive as you get closer to humans. And so what I'm showing here is we took each individual ape and computed separately the spectrum of the NRNC generic compartment in circles versus the ERV compartment in triangles, and normalized for the sort of base composition of each compartment. And so you can see that the main thing separating these points is the phylogeny that ERV DNA in chimps clusters close to non-conserved, non-repetitive DNA in chimps. But then sort of the second order thing is compartments separating in this space. And especially if you look, so this is PC1 and PC2, if you look at PC3 instead, then that really seems to be more separating this ERV compartment from non-repetitive DNA and suggesting at a signature that preferentially targets this in cis. And I'm just going to summarize some quality control measures that, of course, we were worried about, and many others might be too in these analyses. So I mentioned that we had to normalize the spectrum for the composition of compartments to make sure what we're seeing is actually has to do with the SNPs and not the underlying DNA that has an opportunity to mutate. And we also did some bootstrapping where we took subsets of the non-repetitive, non-conserved compartment about the same shape as the ERV compartment. And we verified that these all cluster very close together in the mutation spectrum space, so it doesn't appear to just be an effect of sampling noise. And then we also stratified the SNPs within each compartment by mapping quality and looked at how these might systematically vary from each other. And we did find that the distinctive NRNC spectrum, you see the same thing if you only look at the highest quality SNPs from there. So it doesn't appear to be an artifact of, say, more mapping quality issues in this compartment. And finally, we've also done some normalizing, not in all the plots I've shown you, but in select cases of normalizing for higher order composition of, say, the 7-mer content of each compartment, because we know that there are differences between mutation rates of 7-mers that have the same core 3-mer. And so you could imagine that if one compartment is a different 7-mer composition than another, that you could get spectrum differences that we can explain by that. And so in the cases we've looked at, that doesn't explain the patterns we see. It really seems to be arise from differences of the spectrum in sites that appear to have been mutating or retaining variation in these genomic regions. And so what is this ERV signature I've been alluding to? So when we made these heat map comparisons of the ERV DNA to the non-repetitive, non-conserved DNA of the variation within each species, we sure enough get comparisons that look really similar to each other, suggesting that this ERV-specific signature is pretty conserved across all these species. And so what are these red and blue patches here exactly? Well, first of all, there's a bit of a stripe in the C to T box, which corresponds to higher CpG transition rates in the ERVs, which maybe isn't surprising if they tend to be more heavily methylated than the genome on average. But we see an even stronger signature of these C to G transversions at the same site. And there's indications from the literature that this could be a sign of sort of an alternative epigenetic modification at these sites of when they're hydroxymethylated instead of simply methylated, they tend to resolve via this mutation instead of the C to T mutation. And finally, there are fewer mutations in the ERVs of A to T transversions in a specific TAA context. And this one is interesting because it's at the core of a larger motif that appears to be a hotspot for transposase cleavage and insertion. And so this has been previously shown to be like an extremely highly mutable 7-mer, given that A to T mutations have pretty low rates in general. And so perhaps this ERV compartment is a higher target of this process. And so we also wanted to compare the ERVs to specifically a heterochromatic compartment to see how much of this specific signature is just generically due to DNA repression and how much is more specific to this viral origin DNA. And so we did find that the two appear distinct. And so this is, in humans, the comparison of the ERVs to the non-conserved, non-repetitive compartment as a whole. And then this is a comparison to heterochromatin annotated by the ENCODE project. And so here we had this what we think is the hydroxymethylation signature as well as the regular methylation signature. And then also a signature that we can interpret with the help of Molly and Ipsita's preprint on that showed differences in spectrum of early and late replicating regions. And this C to A transversion bias appears consistent with maybe ERVs being later replicating on average, which like you do see in the annotation. And so when we compare to heterochromatin, these two signatures of the late replication bias and the methylation bias go away. And so maybe these are features of the more large generic compartment, but the hydroxymethylation signature stays there. So maybe that's not one that targets the entire heterochromatin compartment and is more of a specific one. And so this signature of late replication I alluded to also appears to be pretty conserved across the ape phylogeny. So now I have the same non-repetitive, non-conserved compartment, but then there are subsets of the quarter of the genome that replicates the earliest versus the quarter that replicates the latest. And they all sort of separate along this diagonal axis. And then which, like the loadings of it, include these C to A mutations as well as A to T mutations that are replication timing associated in humans. And so just to wrap up, what we're concluding from all this is it looks really like the cis-acting modifiers of mutation spectrum exist, but evolve pretty slowly, are conserved across this ape phylogeny. And so this is a picture of a bunch of compartments together, specifically from gorillas, where the dark ones are non-repetitive DNA, the lighter ones are more repetitive DNA, and then there are also shapes denoting early versus late replication, as well as ERVs and lines and heterochromatin. And so you have sort of this replication timing associated PC1 as, and a repetitive content associated PC2 and PC3, the ERVs separating as we saw before. And you get largely the same thing in bonobos as an example, that within this other species, you see a similar higher order arrangement. And then in the picture in chimps is interesting because of this Western chimp subspecies that I mentioned was distinct. So the Western chimps are these darker blue, and the three other chimp subspecies are these lighter colors that don't separate very much. And so you still have this replication timing axis that seems pretty orthogonal to the subspecies separation, but then the repetitive content axis, it doesn't perfectly align with the separation of the subspecies, but it comes much closer, and that's sort of tantalizing in light of what we know about Western chimps having more repetitive content. And so what we're seeing is just that a lot of these differences in mutability of genomic compartments, we think they exist, but that they've remained pretty stable despite the overall genome-wide spectrum changing a lot. And we haven't found much evidence of evolution of these cis-acting modifiers other than, I didn't show this, but we checked human and chimp recombination hotspots, which do appear more like what you would expect from a cis-acting process that changes quickly. So now we can see that whatever these faster evolving germline mutators are, they fit more the profile of transacting processes that act more uniformly across the genome. And so with that, I'd just like to acknowledge Michael Goldberg, who did most of the new work, as well as my lab and funding sources. And thanks to Molly again and everyone.